This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
We're now going to move on to the panel discussion. One member of our panel, you've now already introduced you to, Donald Ray, and I'd like to introduce you to Jane Colby and to Pat Carvalho. Jane and Pat are going to give you a short introduction to the topic, and then we're going to move to a discussion engaging you from the floor. So if you're ready, Jane, we'll start with you. Thank you.
Obviously, you've got my details in the little book there. Times Trust actually stands for the Young ME Sufferers Trust. We were delighted this year to win the, or be awarded the Queen's Award for Voluntary Service, which is the MBE for volunteer groups, and we were just totally delighted for everybody who helps, because all of us are voluntary. But as you'll see from the thing, I was a head teacher. The point being that I had never heard of anything called ME, and the first I knew was that I got a virus which turned out to be related to polio, which I was bedridden for some years. I was in a wheelchair. It's a long story. I won't bore you with all of that. But the main thing was, when I decided that I would simply have to leave my profession to rebuild my health, because it was just terrible, the consultant microbiologist who had diagnosed me asked me to help her in dealing with the situation with children who had ME, because she said people in education, and indeed a lot of doctors, do not understand it. And that's how I got sort of sucked into this, and that's how I ended up running the trust. I noticed, as someone here from Doncaster, I've been in most places of the UK doing something or other. I gave a lecture at Doncaster Hospital to the doctors there. There's someone here from Sussex. I've spoken in Eastbourne at the conference there. It really is one of these situations that is nationwide, but depending on where you are, you may or may not have seen a lot of children with this illness, because it is the biggest cause of long-term sickness absence from school. But it clusters, as indeed does any illness that is triggered off by infections. So it clusters in schools, in families and communities. Some of you will have seen far more children with this condition than others because of that. And also because of the other thing, which is the fact that very often the children aren't diagnosed very well. Before I hand on, I know we don't have very long each before the discussion. I won't go into a lot of detail, but what I will say is these little threefold leaflets will give you the basics of what you may need to know about ME, and they're outside, and I can always give you more if it comes to it. It's called the Quick Tour of ME, and the most important thing for you to know is that we're not dealing with a psychological condition. We're dealing with potentially severe and chronic neurological disease. It's got rather subsumed under the umbrella of chronic fatigue and chronic fatiguing illnesses. But ME proper, the classic ME, which many doctors will call CFS now, is potentially very, very severe. And we work closely with Nisi Virtual Academy, who sponsored today's event, and are getting fantastic educational results from these children when they can't get to school through virtual education. I think that's all I'll say.
Thank you very much, Jane. And that's a good reflection on this morning's discussion about the provision coming in lots of different ways. Certainly, a number of callers to Skills' own information service helpline have the sort of experiences that you've described. And we'll have an opportunity to discuss supporting children and young people as we go through the panel. But, Pat, I'd like to move on to you next, if that's okay.
Okay, thank you. I'm here to talk about the college perspective in terms of working with NICEI, the Virtual Academy. Before 2008 is when we actually started supporting the Academy. And before that, they had been contracted directly with the LSE, and the LSE approached us to contract with NICEI for two reasons, because they were outgoing themselves and wanted to have something sustainable funding supporting NICEI, and also because NICEI are based in Harrow, and where the college that is in that borough, and we had worked with NICEI before on other projects, but there were quite a lot of hurdles for us as a college, trying to support an organisation that was supporting essentially medically ill learners, and how we can do that. And I just wanted to say very briefly what some of the hurdles were and how we overcame some of those, you know, with an eyesight. Transfer of funding, and you know, if those of you who, a few of you are from FE colleges, know that funding is really important to us kind of taking things forward. The transfer of funding for the programme initially, in actual fact, has remained the same, hasn't changed, even though the number of learners has grown, is around about 136,000. And we also get recurrent funding. In terms of the qualifications that they're, you know, that they're studying as well, and together that package helps to support, you know, the educational needs of the learners. So we had to work with, and we did try with the LSE to see whether we could improve that that funding, which comes through ALS, and is as I said a fixed rate, but we couldn't. And so we've looked at other ways that we can, how we can try and support and be efficient in the way that we do things. And I'll say something more about that. Learner numbers is another issue for us because what the LSE, in terms of wanting to make it sustainable, was to build it into our own learner numbers, you know, for the college. And for colleges, we've all been capped certainly with under the new funding arrangements now. So we had to think very carefully, because having started out with NISA, and I've mentioned that we've grown the number of learners that are, you know, they are able to support, we've now had to put a cap on what, you know, we can, you know, support in funding terms. Because we have to think about, for the college, our wider learners, the numbers that we have, you know, currently for other provision that we're, you know, that we're running locally, you know, for, you know, for Harrow, you know, 16 to 19 year olds as well. So that's an issue. Location was an issue. The NISA used to operate and support learners outside of England as well as within, and we can't fund, because we're a college within England, you know, anybody outside of that process. I mean, they can take them on, but that's at their own, you know, financial risk. Age range has to be 16 to 18. However, the college does support learners who start out at 18 with NISI. We will accept, if you like, that there is no funding for them in order for them to complete that second year of a programme, and usually they are with NISI for 2 years. And majority of them are between 16 to 18 for those 2 years, but there are a few that go over, and we accept that, you know once we've said we're going to take them on, that we will continue to do so, and we accept that loss. Eligibility of qualifications was an issue, because part of the qualifications NISA used to offer was at Key Stage 3 and 4, which is not funded for post-16. Mm-hmm. So we had to work with NISA in terms of the qualifications that are offered. And the majority of them that are offered now are actually GCSEs, A-levels, used to be key skills, will now be functional skills. And students are very successful. You know, certainly success rates are in the high 70s. And I think that's actually, you know, remarkable. When you think that learners will be on programme, will actually withdraw from the programme through, you know, when they become ill, and in that 2 year period come back again at a later time. And it's that support and the connection through the programme that they get that enables them to achieve. So I mentioned about funding. Contracts was really important. We agreed with NISA that they would obviously get the majority of the funding because they're the ones who are supporting the learners. So, you know, just over 72% funding goes to them. The rest gives us the support that we need in order to support them with quality assurance, because we actually do observations. We actually see how the actual live classrooms are working. We manage all the actual data requirements through our MIS. We have a dedicated administrator that is following through on attendance and retention and all sorts of those sorts of issues. So we have got a lot of people, as well as one or two dedicated people who work with NISI. So, you know, that rest of that, you know, the money out of the funding goes towards supporting all of that. I've mentioned about qualifications, and I've mentioned about quality, and we've made sure, in order for it to be part of what we do, that that our quality team that we have is no different to what we have in the college, because we want to make sure that we have the same kind of standards. And we had an Ofsted inspection in October last year, who went to see some of the... sorry, he didn't go to see the learners, but actually saw them through a live observation at the centre, and we're really pleased with the way that the software works and how the tutors were engaging with the learners. We've worked really hard with NISO to make sure that our systems and their systems talk to each other. And this academic year, we now have access to NISO's own data systems, which has really helped in terms of that monitoring of attendance and retention. And, alongside that is also working out, making sure that we're doing everything correct around enrolment forms and processes. As I've said, there are eligibility criteria that we need to make sure are in place. And we worked hard to keep that timely and accurate, because as anybody in FE knows, you've got to do your returns on time. And that does not change, regardless of who the learner is. I've mentioned about the success rates, and they have gone up, since we've worked with NISO, and we'd like to think that we've been part of that raising of quality that has happened. But one of the things that we have done is also built it, it made sure that they're part of our own internal audit, so that we can make sure that if there are issues, we can actually try to resolve them, together. And usually the issues have been around, technically, around data management, and so on. And that's been really helpful. So that we've had it, so when we've called our external auditors in to do our internal audit, they've looked at NISO as well in terms of our relationship with them and how we work to make sure that, we're on track in doing the things that we need to do. However, there is one unresolved issue that we have, and that is about examination entries and exam centres.
I can echo that.
and locally is not a problem, because we're a centre, we're a registered centre. So for anybody that comes to NISO, we can register with the college, and everything works very smoothly. We work extremely hard with local authorities around the country and with connections and so on, to try to get to help support parents to find, exam centres that will accept them, but also that won't charge exorbitant fees, because that's one of the issues that stops them enrolling their children on these programmes as well. So it's a really big issue, and I do think there needs to be something that is not about being managed locally, in the sense of us doing it and NISO trying to do it, but it really does need a national solution, because you to be charging different rates for what is an examination that students are entitled to between the ages of 16 and 18, doesn't seem to be right, really. So that's something that we work with all the time. And obviously, where we have good relationships with local authorities in different boroughs and so on, we try to make sure we keep the connections and work with them. But that's really the biggest issue, that we have.
Thank you very much, Pat. Seb started us off this morning with a challenge to commissioners of delivering education in different ways and engaging with voluntary organisations in different ways. And we've heard from Jane about a group who may need a different delivery for a certain time in their lives, and from Pat as to how, as a fairly mainstream provider, how they've actually managed to do this. Donald, I wanted to ask you first if local authorities are really tuned in to the kind of range of provision which could cover learning difficulty and disability, that this is just a good example of.
Yeah. That was really interesting, listening to both of those contributions, because it highlighted for me the key issues about how do we simplify the system which allows that sort of freedom and removes as many barriers as possible. Just to answer your question, some local authorities are further ahead than others, to be clear. But that's one of the issues that REACT is still pressing with the YPLA, about how do local authorities get all the information about the range of providers who are out there. In the post-19 world, the Skills Funding Agency have ACTOR, don't ask me what it stands for, but a database of providers. Right? That's harder for local authorities, because we don't have that pre-16, and the the key issue of local authorities is how do we bring the two systems together. So there is some work that the LGA is doing about how do we make sure local authorities have that information. And that's not perfect. And I think, but there's a bit of me that says don't wait for that to happen at a national level. We're not going to solve it. You make as many contacts as you can with as many local authorities as you can. However, there are some issues. The exam centres one is a key issue, and the department has recently put some guidance out reminding local authorities of their role in terms of supporting young people who are medically ill, making sure they have access to examination centres. However, very much in the model of localism, they said it's up to local authorities to decide what the charges are. And I think the idea that we're going to solve this nationally isn't going to happen. Right? Not least because actually the problem lies with the examination boards in the main. Right?
Partly. Yes.
Partly.
And the controlled conditions that have come in have made it harder for any kind of external student at all, not just medically ill, to access it.
And there's a whole, there's a danger we'll spend the rest of the day talking about exam boards. exam boards and taxis and transport are issues we perhaps should avoid. But there's a whole set of issues around all of that. And how we bring together, and really good examples here of colleges working with voluntary sector organisations. You could have many 14 to 16 examples of that as well. And I think there's some issues about how we free that up. Just one final bit about data. Carol and I were at a meeting earlier this week. You thought the LSC was dead. Well, the LSC External Advisories Group met this week. Right? Except we had someone from the YPLA and somebody from the Skills Funding Agency, but it was the same group. And one of the parts of discussion was about the Skills Funding Agency document sent out last week freeing up post-19 providers and saying you've got more freedoms. One of the questions was then, that's really welcome. Are you now going to free us up by not collecting so much data? Unfortunately, the response was, oh no, because we freed you up, we'll need to collect more. Right? Which got the sort of reaction you would expect. So I think there's a whole set of issues about, do we need all this data collection? How do we free providers up and remove a lot of those barriers as well? Because there's an awful lot of data gets collected and we must wonder why.
Thank you very much. I'd like to throw the discussion open now. This is an example that we presented to you, but you may have in your own area things you're trying to do or would like to do, maybe looking for a partner. So who would like to start off the discussion from the floor? Right, thank you very much.
Right, sorry, it's me again.
That's
I've got lots
fine.
Of questions. I was really interested in the example which was presented here, and it's actually really kind of an innovative project and an innovative kind of way of working. But in order for us as a local authority commissioner to move forward and bring on new providers, if there's no extra funding, we may have to decommission existing provision to actually bring new providers on, I guess. And I'm not quite sure how that process might work and what the implications are for actually trying to extend the quality and the availability and the range and the diversity of provision for learners with learning difficulties and disabilities in terms of the decommissioning and commissioning process.
Thank you. I'm going to have to start with you, Donald, but there may be others in the room who can contribute.
Mm. That's a really big question. At one level, it's who is responsible for ensuring that there is a range of providers in a local area for young people to choose provision from, and whether that's a school, a college, or a specialist provider. So who does that? At the moment, it's partly local authorities, but for FE colleges, it's the Skills Funding Agency. So there's a general issue at a macro level about have we got the right range of provision and institutions available in a particular area. And there are discussions have gone on between the Local Government Association and the Skills Funding Agency about how that would work, and the YPLA as well. However, underneath that, that's the key question about the local authority role in commissioning. Because if local authority X, I won't locate this anywhere, wants to develop more engineering provision or more provision with young people with learning difficulties, and the local college doesn't do that, how do they find the money to bring a new provider in? And I think we're just going to have to let that one run through. And I know that is happening in some authorities where they will say, we want more of X. And they'll have that conversation with the YPLA to then recruit, by whatever procurement method, new providers. And that can be sometimes at a very small level. It might be in a rural area, it may only be a group of 20 or so learners that need to have that provision. And if there's no one making it, they will want to procure that. So I know that is happening in lots of local authorities. Those conversations are going on with the existing provider network. And I guess most colleges would say, well, we can do that, and they would want to adjust and bend their provision to do it. But the time will come somewhere, I'm not quite sure where yet, where a local authority is saying, well, nobody can do that. So they'll want to procure it. And there'll be different ways of doing that. So I think it is much going to be out there, and that will be opportunities for the third sector and others, and that mix, I think, will develop. But as I said, at the macro level, I think that's a different sort of discussion about how many school six forms do we need. That might not be an issue that is decided anymore. That might just be left to the market. How many academies have six forms? There's a whole set of issues around all of those sorts of issues that I think we just have to wait and see.
Can I come in there? Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that you talk about the market, because this whole business of micro, macro, top down, bottom up, seems to me that there is money there for a child to be educated, and the principle that the money follows the child is not a bad principle. If that child is at home sick and is entitled to education, then it should be, it seems to me, not beyond the bounds of possibility for the money to be channeled into something that is available, even if it means, when you talk about commissioning, not necessarily, you know, setting up a new or buying in a provider in terms of their whole services, but by child. So that, in other words, I know it happens already with the Nisai Virtual Academy to a certain extent. If the child needs home tuition, for example, which I know we're talking about post-16 here, it's a different situation. Now, with a school under 16, it actually would cost half as much for that school to buy in a course, say, in one subject for the child, than it would to send a home tutor around there. So we're not actually talking about something that's more expensive. And it must apply in the same way post-16, I would have thought. If businesses are out there able to supply courses, why cannot colleges and other people commission the course as opposed to commission the provider, provided they approve of what the provider is providing and if the child or the student wants that? Now, we know it's working, and I think the difficulty we've got is that if provision isn't properly made, what will happen is people within the education service will find themselves on the wrong end of a lawsuit because, for example, with ME, we're talking about something where the brain is seriously affected. When they make an effort, the oxygen to the brain goes down instead of up. So they're confused. So they can't necessarily get to a place of education without feeling worse. And when they get there, they can't think straight. Therefore, we're looking at disability discrimination laws. And I suspect that sometimes things only really get shaken up when there's a big lawsuit. The Tandy case was one in point. The Tandy case established that if a child is supposed to have certain special educational needs which the local authority has agreed they have, they cannot then refuse to provide for those special educational needs on the grounds of cost, as a result of which, of course, a lot of local education authorities now won't accept that certain children have got those special educational needs. If they accept that officially, then they've got to provide for them, and they can't say we can't afford it. And the Tandy case was a family that I knew. They went right through to the law lords and eventually won. And I suspect, I hope it doesn't come down to a very nasty law case, but disability discrimination law could come in here, I think.
Thank you for your contributions. The question was from Southwark, and I wondered if there were other London colleagues who'd like to comment, because London is commissioning as a local authority wide group. Does anyone want to come in? Before I come, I will come back to you, but are there other colleagues from London who'd like to contribute to that first? Feeling shy? Fortunately, I don't know you, or I would be picking on you from the floor. Okay, we will go back to our colleague in Southwark then. Thank you.
I really don't want to kind of hog the floor, so sorry about that.
I think
this
is a really important issue, though. So
okay,
I think people
good.
Will want to try and get some clues as to what to do when they go back home tonight.
Okay. I just want to just comment on Jane's reaction. I completely agree with you. We have a responsibility to make sure that the education is provided statutory until children are 16. And actually, with the raising of participation age to 18, this will actually become more and more salient. But just to come back, in Southwark, for example, we've done a lot of analysis on the needs of children with special ed, with a statement to special educational needs. And we know that coming through the system, we've got around 20% of the cohort who are autistic or on the autistic spectrum. And so in terms of future planning, we're going to have a dialogue with the college and other providers about actually how we will then deal with these children in the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years plus. And so in relation to commissioning and actually drafting our commissioning statements, which then go to the RPG and up to the YPLA, it's really important that we, you know, we actually account for this. And it's just, it's quite difficult when you sit there and actually kind of think, okay, I've got to put a commissioning statement together and I know what the data is telling me about what I should be commissioning, but actually how do I... You know, if the college is unable to provide it, how do I then, or hasn't got the capacity to actually deal with the level of need, how do I then make sure that there's adequate provision for these learners post 16 and, you know, with raising the participation age up to the age of 18?
Thank you, and I think that's something we'll come on to in this afternoon session as well, as to how we share the very expert expertise there is on autism and the local authorities' response to it. And London is a very good example of, you know, there are few boundaries in London other than those parts of South London where I live where there is no tube, but a lot of buses, as to how we actually take away those kind of local authority thoughts of I'm in Southwark and you're in Lambeth, and that's a process being worked through. And I think we have to take Donald's advice. Actually, we don't know the answers to all these questions yet, but they are excellent questions and we should keep asking them. The fact that we don't have all the answers doesn't mean we don't keep raising it.
And the issue of autism, I think, is in every local authority. And again, we will hear what Nottinghamshire has done this afternoon. But I know many authorities where they're planning for the needs of young people with autism post-16. They're actually wanting solutions from the college sector, whether that's specialist colleges or general FE colleges. That's where the solution lies. So I think wherever you are, that discussion is going on.
Thank you. Another topic from the floor? Yes, thank you very much. You could just tell us who you are and where you're from.
My name's Kate Crullen. I'm from one of the smallest local authorities, from Darlington. So our cohort of 16-year-olds will be around about 1,400 16-year-olds. So we are very small. Of course, we're very small and beautiful. What we managed to do with the sort of commissioning for 2010 in terms of post-16 provision was to get an additional amount of money that would pay for an additional up to 17 learners with learning difficulties and disabilities with the associated ALS with that. And we felt that we had sort of a lack of provision for children with emotional behavioural difficulties and with autistic spectrum disorder. And we felt that that was where we really needed to build some provision, because we had really virtually nothing in Darlington itself, and we had learners who were going out of Darlington for that. Our nearest independent specialist provider is in Sunderland, and I just say the cost of transport there on a daily basis is £27,000 a year. So, you know, we were quite focused on the need to develop something that was more local. And what we are in a very, I'm a little bit sort of embarrassed about speaking about it, because it's not in the bag yet, but we are in a very delicate stage of negotiation with Darlington College, which is an outstanding post-16 college, you know, which is just down the road, obviously, from the town hall, because we're very, very small geographically as well. And what they have agreed to look at and are currently, I think, doing that assessment at the moment is to subcontract to a provider that is, in fact, not sitting in Darlington itself, it's just outside Darlington. It's called the Clairvaux Trust, whose background is from Ruskin Mill Education Trust, mm-hmm. who are independent specialist providers, and Freeman College and Glasshouse College. So their kind of background and their tradition is from there, but they are a standalone trust. And the local authority is in partnership with them for a back-on-track project from what was the Department for Curtains and Soft Furnishings. Mm. We got some money from them for a back-on-track project for 14 to 16-year-olds. And because they've got, you know, kind of a setup and a framework, and they've got the capacity to actually expand, we're looking at around about the moment about seven learners who are really quite vulnerable, who could not go into Darlington College as it stands at the moment. And what the college is saying that they want to do is actually transport virtually all of that funding. So the ALS is in the region of £160,000 for up to 17 learners, but they're actually willing to transport all of that. And, you know, also the actual funding for the course itself, where they will actually take, that was where they will take their cut for the administration and so on. So the barriers have been a little bit around making sure that absolutely all the qualifications and the curriculum and the details of how that will be delivered, all of the paperwork and the bureaucracy that goes along with that, all of the health and safety and safeguarding and all of those issues that are hugely important, it's actually just making sure that they meet all of the sort of outstanding systems that pertain in the college, because the college are going to take the risk because they're the ones who will be inspected. I mean, they may well have a visit, I suppose, at the Clairvaux Trust if Ofsted came again, but at the moment it will be the college that would take that risk. But I've got my fingers crossed. I'm kind of going, I'm 90%, you know, at the moment, but it still may not happen. And if it doesn't, we have got seven very vulnerable learners in Darlington, and we don't know what we're going to do with them. But I'm really hopeful. I think it's going to happen.
Thank you very much. So, Donald, do you want to come in?
That's really good news for me, because that just gives more ammunition, because what I've been saying is that if this gets out, the whole process will allow these local discussions to take place and this type of innovative practice will develop. What we need to do is to free up the system to enable it to happen. So, for example, how do general FE colleges, whether they're working with the third sector or whoever, access the YPLA LLDD budget that's held at a national level, particularly when the funds are, the costs are over 19,000. There's a whole set of issues around that. So that's one issue about how do we free that system up. The other benefit of all the 16 to 19 commissioning being with local authorities now is that many local authorities are linking the commissioning for provision for 14 to 16-year-olds who are not in schools. So that's not just people who are in pupil referral units or short-stay schools, get the title right, but that whole range of vulnerable young people who are not in schools, much more regulated, thankfully, than it was before. But many authorities are linking that commissioning with the commissioning for 16 to 19 and much more joined-up process there. So the commissioning provision for a 14-year-old thinks about, well, how are they going to stay in learning through till 18, not just until 16. So again, there are advantages there for a whole set of different set of organisations and providers about how they work together to help local authorities do that, including 14-year-olds obviously being in colleges.
Mm-hmm. Pat, do you want to say some more about that? Darlington College is going to be in the same position you are, yes, in a way with NISAC.
Yeah, I mean, I think where it, I mean, it, you know, it can work, and it's currently working, you know where we are. But I think, you know, there are fundamental issues that you come against, not with the numbers that you're talking about, but actually with, you know, when you become successful and you want to kind of route things through a particular way, colleges have to start making some very, you know, hard decisions about all its learners and how everything, you know, impacts, you know, in terms of, you know, reduction in funding and so on. And we have to take those things into account. And, you know, and one of the things, thinking about the, you know, the changes with the QCF, you know, is that there are, you know, reduced, not necessarily for A-levels and GCSEs that we're doing currently, but for other programmes that might be of you know, of benefit, you know, there's reduced funding because there's reduced, you know, they reduce the hours, they reduce the actual level of funding. So there's lots of things that impact on how well you can support and how much, you know, and, you know, you do want to give the majority of that funding to the other organisation that is, you know, who's doing the work with the, you know, with the individuals. And you want to do that in a way that allows them to be sustainable and to be successful. Because at the end of the day, the college, because those numbers are the college's numbers, you are taking on the risk. And, you know, that, and that's quite a, you know, a big deal. I mean, I will say one of the things that we did negotiate with the LSE was that because, you know, the learners are medically ill and they will be coming in and out of, you know, in and out of studying, that where we can prove, we can show that it is because of their illness why they, you know, they couldn't complete and so on, that we don't have to count their non-success as part of our success rates. And that was quite an important thing, you know, that we actually negotiated at the time. And I'm not too sure how, where that stands with the YPLA, and that's something we're going to have to kind of, you know, look into, you know, with them. But that's the kinds of things that overall that, you know, that, you know, colleges get judged by, and they don't look at the nuances behind there as to why those things happen. In an Ofsted inspection, they do look at those things, and they do take those things into account and actually celebrate, you know, the work that you do, which is great. But unfortunately, in funding terms, it's just not there at all.
Might I just comment on the issue of risk that you mentioned? I think risk is an interesting one when it comes to the medically ill, because obviously anybody who is providing for young people has got a duty of care.
Yes.
And of course, where you've got the medically ill, you've got what are the doctors saying is right for the young person, and what do I think is right for them educationally? And sometimes you will disagree with what the doctors say. And I think the difficulty there is to make sure that you don't do something that exposes you to a dereliction of your duty of care. And the reason I mention it is because there's a good example within ME itself in that the medical profession is split about how best to handle these children. So you will get very compassionate paediatricians and doctors who are dealing with the youngsters over 16 and who will basically say, we realise this is a matter of convalescence and taking care of yourself and doing what you can within your own limitations. And then you get a different group of doctors who are fully committed to sort of programmes of integration, which are really rather done to the young person, as opposed, you know, the, it's a sort of increase what you do by 10% a week approach, which is fair enough if you're physically unfit and you just need to get fit again. But if you're physically ill and your systems are not working properly, then clearly that can, you know, have a detrimental effect on the child. So you've got a medical split. Well, your decision as an educationist is really, how do I provide an education for these young people? You know, it, to a certain extent, the medics will have to sort that out amongst themselves. Mm-hmm. You need to not suspend your own educational judgment, really. And I would also say with children with ME, I mean, the social aspect is a separate issue. If they're not well enough to socialise, it's pie in the sky just to think, wouldn't it be nice if they were there so they can socialise? Yes. Wouldn't it be nice if they were well? Yes. You know, but since we're not in that ballpark, they can socialise as they do with the Nissai Virtual Academy in a sort of Hogwarts situation where they've got teams and the teachers are part of the houses and all of this and a well-being centre. And if they can't actually be there physically, well, they can be there in spirit, can't they? And it gives them such a boost. So I bring up the issue of risk because you will be in a situation where you may need to make decisions based on your own educational judgment. And just be a little bit careful when you're doing that, I think.
I think you're absolutely right, and that is part of the judgment we leave with NISAI, who actually have got, you know,
yes,
the trained tutors and so on. So, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
So everything I talk about is
exactly
in relation to, is clearly in relation to that.
Mm.
But, you know, I agree.
Thank you very much. And thank you. Sorry. You'd have to wait for the
Microphone to arrive, that's it. Thank you.
Yeah, Rob Bates from City College Norwich. I think there is this risk factor is sort of a bit of a nonsense, really, if I'm saying, because we run a programme in City College for 100... And we've got a foundation studies of about 550, 600 students. 150 of those are hard-to-reach learners with ME, emotional behavioural difficulties, from the age of 14 to 19. And they take GCSEs, BTECs, whatever. Highest success rate across the college. That's not a risk, as far as I'm concerned. And I think we're probably trying to hide behind this. Well, there's a risk to it. No,
actually,
there isn't.
I'm not actually saying... I'm just saying the duty of care is an important thing.
Yeah, I understand that, but I think if the support's correct, if the assessment's done in the first place correctly, then the risk is not there, or not as high as what we make out.
And it's part of the college management to ensure
it's
that.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because clearly, I mean, I speak from one point, and I see things on the advice line that come in which would make your hair curl. I know, sorry, your toes curl. I mean, you know... But seriously, terrible things where the child has been forced in and made ill, and the parents are so concerned with trying to deal with the fact that the child's been made ill that they actually don't take legal action against the school, but one day somebody will. And, you know, the important thing from your point of view is sometimes when doctors are giving conflicting views, well, what's the best thing educationally? And obviously that's clearly what you're about. Yeah.
Indeed. And with the change, I accept what our colleague said about the raising of the participation age, but actually it is the senior management of the college that is deciding those things as to what is the ethos of your college and what do you provide. And that's going to be a consideration taken all over the country with these new commissioning arrangements. We do need to move on if we're going to get time for lunch. Is there anyone bursting to ask a question before we do that they feel hasn't been addressed? You're okay. I'd like to thank both my colleagues on the panel and from the floor about these are very important considerations of provision for quite small groups of students at any one time. And these are the students that we're all very concerned that get a proper transition and get a good management structure within the college to design and provide along with the local authority, the clusters, the regional development. We are in a position where we've had an awful lot of change in an awfully short time. But the ethos, thank you, Jane, for saying that, is education. That's what we do, that's what we're here to do, and that we keep sharing with each other what we're doing and how we're doing it, because I think the answers are going to be at that local level, and I think that was your message, Donald, if I can paraphrase you. So if we could thank the panel very much, then I'm going to give you a little bit of roundup myself.